This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to this episode of LGIM Talks. I'm Max Julius. I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, Chief Investment Officer, and Emil van den Heiligenberg, Head of Asset Allocation, to discuss the outlook for markets into year-end and beyond. Sonia and Emil, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Well, in our latest CIO outlook, which includes contributions from our economists, from our CIO, from our asset allocation team, from the solutions team, and from fixed income strategists, and which should be hot off the press when this episode airs, you both discuss the opportunities and risks that investors are facing at this point in the economic cycle. So I'll start by asking, what's your base case macro view over the near term?
It's fair to say that there's no shortage of negative headlines, and it's very clear that a lot of investors are very concerned and to some extent even panicky. We have seen lots of movement and higher volatility over the short term. So it is very important to understand really what is the economic data telling us, what are political headlines, and how can we bring it all together. So if you look at the economic data points, it's very clear that we have been in a decelerating phase for some time, very much pronounced in the manufacturing sector rather than the consumer-related sectors. And this is why our base case actually has been reasonably stable or robust, because the consumer in most economies is the largest contributor to economic growth. Now, if you add then the political headlines, this is when it becomes much more difficult, because if you think about the trade tensions and then here closer to home, the upcoming Brexit negotiations and the risk of a no-deal Brexit, then it is clear that both of these events have the potential to negatively influence the outlook. So even having a base case, it means you need to take a stance beyond this and consider how important these two events can be.
And given all of that, how likely is it that the global economy avoids a recession?
That is something we have been assessing, and it is difficult because if you think about what normally triggers a recession, it's clear that it normally is a overheating, which triggers higher inflation, and the central bank reaction function is to raise rates, which then triggers the credit cycle, which normally brings the economic cycle to an end. Now we have a very interesting phenomenon here that particularly when you look at Europe, there is obviously a weakening. You have seen Germany with a negative print for the latest GDP growth. And as such, obviously, we're in a situation where external shocks, i.e. Brexit with no deal, could obviously tip over the European economy into recession, which is not necessarily textbook, but is a likelihood. So we're looking at this kind of dual opportunity on how things unfold. And clearly, obviously, the trade tensions have the risk of weakening global growth further.
Yeah, let me jump in there. So, Sonia, you spoke about sort of the economy, the risks to the downside, and politics. That sort of sums it up if I think about it as an asset allocator. What I told in probably a few podcasts even as well in the past is the economic cycle is one of the most important drivers of long-term expected returns of asset classes. So expected risk and return of asset class significantly varies over the cycle. So our economist view, and Sonia sort of expressed that, sort of that growth risks are now skewed to the downside. And recession risks, although not our base case, are clearly a risk to be reckoned with. And that is a fact in a way, or a view in a way, which cannot be ignored by asset allocators. And later on, we're going to talk about views, so I'll wait for that when we go into specific views. But it's important to realize that equity markets anticipate recessions sort of 6 to 9 months before the recession actually happens. So equity investors are clearly forward looking and are pretty good actually in predicting those recessions. That means us asset allocators or us asset managers, if we want to do right for our clients, need to get sort of 6 to 9 months ahead of the economic cycle and start to anticipate risks. And that's what I think is almost the theme of our outlook. Is we have to start anticipating those risks.
Right, very interesting. Well, so staying with the theme of risks, then Sonia, what are the key tail risks you associate with the macro view you just outlined?
One very important factor that we haven't mentioned yet, obviously, is the reaction function of central banks, because we should not forget that they hold a very important functions and have so far held the key to how asset markets have been performing. So if we think about the importance of central bank, it's clear that we have to understand what needs to happen to change the reaction function of central banks, because that is a key risk to how assets are priced right now and is hence something that investors should be aware of. If you think about particularly the fixed income world and bond markets, it is clear that inflation is the one ingredient that has been very, very subdued, as we know. It has led to long discussions among experts why inflation actually is absent in this cycle, despite the fact that the US is now operating at a positive output gap. Labor markets have been very strong in a lot of developed markets, yet inflation has not materialized to an extent that would have been expected or associated with that level of economic strength. So that has led to a bit of complacency among investors that, you know, inflation has not been a threat until now, and it's pretty benign everywhere. So, you know, let's assume this is not going to happen. And hence, obviously, the strong expectations that central banks will remain supportive and will actually add extra stimulus. So a tail risk has to be what happens if inflation is not dead and there is more inflation in the system than we currently price. And so that is an area where we're looking at. And it's clear when you look at the fixed income spectrum and the universe there that investors would not be positioned at all if central banks cannot provide the support expected and inflation would force in a hiking cycle that currently is not priced in.
Right. And that would pull the rug out of the fixed income rally, the very aggressive rally we've seen of late. So just referring back to one of the sections in our outlook, I know there's a discussion of fallen angels, which for our listeners aren't lovely heavenly beings out of Milton's poetry, but actually a function of credit markets. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about the risks posed by that area of the market.
Absolutely. The fallen angel idea, so what do we mean by a fallen angel? It is the potential that an investment-grade bond, albeit with the weakest investment-grade rating, receives a downgrade, which then justifies to be classified as high yield. So that is a fallen angel concept. And the reason why we're looking at it is the sheer explosion in the investment-grade corporate bond segment, and in particular in the weakest of the investment grade credit spectrums. This actually has led to a deterioration in the quality of investment grade indices to a historic low. So that, to be put in context of what we've just said in terms of the expectation around the economic cycle, the expectation that a recession risk has risen. So what would this mean if we assumed even a normal downgrade cycle in association with a downturn? You know, what's the volume? And I think this is what we're mostly interested in. We're not forecasting, or we've not been looking really for a dramatic increase in the default rate. It's predominantly the risk around just a normal downgrade cycle, because it's just the sheer explosion in volumes that worries us. Because something that has happened simultaneously is a change in regulation for investment banks, who used to be the natural counterparty and provider of liquidity for the fixed income market. So if we assume that there's less liquidity out there, but potentially more need for liquidity in the context of fallen angels, we clearly believe that is something that investors should be very aware of. And we are spending a lot of time of our fundamental bottom-up research in identifying where the weakest link in that universe is.
So moving on to a related area, I'm sure everyone will have seen the headlines about ever larger numbers of fixed income securities with negative yields, you know, with trillions of bonds trading in negative territory. Do both of you believe there's a bubble in fixed income? How low can yields go, and what would a shift in a central bank reaction function that you've just discussed, Sonia, what would that mean for the market?
I'd gladly leave the first reaction to Sonia. I'm out of courtesy, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, this literally closes the circle back to the central banks, because we first have to understand, you know, how did we get there in the first place, right? Is there a bubble? And I think we have tried to answer this question in understanding what would we consider be bubble-like behavior. Where's the exuberance? Where's the kind of excess that we have seen? Where's the risk or the dissociation of fundamentals with the actual asset class? And again, we have to go back to obviously the central bank and the massive monetary stimulus that markets have received over the past 10 years, and that actually have created a search for yield that is very obvious, obviously in the government bonds space, so in the safer fixed income asset classes, but it has manifested itself across the entire credit spectrum. If you look at credit spreads, so the difference, i.e. the risk premium that a credit would offer you over the respective government bond, are at historic tights, which means that your margin of safety has been reduced to a level that can only be justified because investors are desperate to find some yield. The interesting fact around negative yielding bonds is more the fact that we conceptually struggle, the human mind struggles with the idea that an asset with a negative connotation in front of the yield is something that would be attractive. So again, given that fundamentals in the bond market are supported by central bank action, yes, we have seen some exuberance in more exotic credit areas because the search for yield was so widespread that we have seen some areas that do concern us. But in a way, a bubble linked to what central bank action has delivered, I think we would not support.
Yeah, let me jump in there as well. So I obviously also don't believe that bonds are in a bubble. They are completely pricing with fundamentals, in a way. But it's also important to realize, we get a lot of questions from clients or journalists on sort of like, is there a problem with negative yields? Well, important to realize that actually total returns of bonds have been really, really high. Thanks to the falling yields, bond investors have sort of benefited from that bonanza. And it also depends a little bit on which bonds you're talking about. Bonds which have a negative yield, but bonds have a higher yield for a UK investor or for a US investor if he currency hedge that investment in German bonds. Then this sort of it's higher than gilts or it's higher than U.S. Treasuries. So that's something which is so people often find surprising.
So that's if you switch those cash flows in euros into sterling,
yes,
or dollars,
or into dollars. Yeah. So that's one thing. And then we often ask sort of like, does this change sort of investor behavior? Because forward looking, you could say if you have a negative yield on a bond, what are you going to make on that investment? So the answer is yes, but the answer is only marginally. So you see small walks up, and so small increases in the maturity of the bonds, people buying a bit further up in the curve, and people buying a bit more credit risk in their portfolios. So that's and then also people start to think about alternative investments like REITs and infrastructure, and eventually a probably tiny move into a little bit more equities. Why only marginal? Is because, well, many investors have liabilities and need to match their liabilities. So they need to own fixed income. So insurance companies and pension funds need to own liabilities. And many investors are constrained by their total risk budget. So they cannot easily sort of increase their allocation towards risky assets.
So, right, regardless of the negative sign that the human mind struggles to compute, as Sonia puts it, people will still be forced to hold negative yielding bonds.
Needless to say, to understand the impact, should the reaction function of central banks changes. So that I think is the important element to understand, that yes, we have to understand the fundamentals and what potentially could lead to a change in those fundamentals and hence a different reaction from central banks. Unless we see a dramatic change, it is exactly as Emil just said. And that's the importance in understanding negative yielding bonds. But it's without any doubt that we are operating in an environment that has not been there before. And as such, we need to be humble enough to understand unintended consequences that might emerge. And as such, we are spending so much time understanding the base case, the tail risk, to be prepared for the eventualities if the game changes.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah, I've got one more follow-up, actually. Yeah. So what I thought about sort of how to make how to make of this as an asset allocator. And that's sort of three relevant consequences. So one is, as I told, investors are buying further, longer maturities. That means the yield curve, so when you talk about the yield curve short, from short end to very long end, must be distorted, because compared to previous in history, people are buying more long-term maturities. There's lots of debate in the market around what does the signal of an inverted yield curve in the US give? Is that the determinant recession indicator? We say yes, it's definitely something to take into account, but it's not the be-all end-all because of this distortion by negative yield. The second one is credit spreads. Sonja already spoke a lot about the credit market, but because people buy a bit more credits, all else equals, given the negative yields, because they are looking for yields, that means credit spreads are exceptionally narrow compared to the past. And that then leads to equity valuations. You can think about equity valuations in absolute terms. Is the equity market expensive? But we as asset allocators, we think about multi-asset way. So we very often think about, is the equity market expensive relative to alternatives? And one of the alternatives is fixed income. And we think because interest rates are so low, equity markets are actually not that expensive relative to fixed income.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about how you as an asset allocator are operating in this new environment we face ourselves in addition to
positions absolutely. Like that? Absolutely. I think of little else, so yeah. So first of all, in the beginning, Sonja and I spoke about the cycle. And the result of our cautious cyclical view, if I can summarize sort of that first answer in one summary, means we have taken profit on our long equity position. We had a medium-term position, which is positive equities. That means in some accounts we were overweight if we had a benchmark, or we had a relatively high weight towards equities. That has worked out well. But you see that sort of the dark clouds around the economy are gathering. And that means we have a marginal change in that, and we bring that equity weight back to a more neutral position. In a way, what does that mean? That means where we would say we would buy on dips, we would probably now be more inclined to sell on strength. So that's the overall equity view. If you think about it in region allocation, we recently sold Eurozone equities. So the AMU equities relative to the rest of the world. Why? They have done reasonably well year to date. So the sentiment around those equities is pretty positive. Investors like them. And if you then talk to our European economist, Hetal Mehta, she's quite negative about the Eurozone specifically, because the Eurozone has impact from global. It's a very global open economy. And it has the risk of Brexit, because the Eurozone will suffer from Brexit as well. And it has the risk from further trade war escalation as well, because typically, specifically Germany, is very sensitive to trade war impacts. So that means we basically sold European equities and bought a bit of rest of the world on the equity side. And then last point to make in terms of interesting trade ideas people should think about in our view is that relative valuation between equities and fixed income, and in this case specifically credits. If you take risk in your portfolio, and everyone should take some risk in their portfolio, otherwise the returns are negative, that we would prefer to take that risk in equities rather than into credits. A couple of reasons for that. Well, the low rates, the low credit spreads, we spoke about that. So the valuations of equities is more attractive than credits. We're concerned about the sort of internal machinations of the credit market, so the fallen angel topic Sonja spoke about. And then last but not least, you want to have liquidity in your portfolio when things go wrong. Credits are less liquid than equities, right? So you rather own equities when things go wrong, because you can quickly adapt your position, where in credits that is more difficult to do.
Drilling down into client needs, what does this negative yield environment mean for, say, defined benefit pension scheme trustees who may one day need to reflect negative yields in their discount rates?
Yeah, so Sonia and I work very closely together with our solutions team. And our solutions team, well, and I would say Sonia and I as well, we advise the largest investor in the world. We talk to the largest investors in the world. And then also the largest UK DB pension funds are, we're lucky enough to have them as clients as well. So basically, we sort of mentioned four different things where they need to think of in this sort of low yield or even negative yield environment. There's no room to be complacent. That's probably the overall overarching thing. So one is hedge interest rate risk. Even though you thought interest rates could not go lower, and you thought that 2-3 years ago, and many people have told me that 2-3 years ago, we now know they can go lower, and they can go lower still. So hedge your interest rate risk to the extent that it makes sense in your specific situation. The second is diversify. If Brexit learns us anything, then it makes sense to diversify your portfolio. That's diversify over different asset classes, and it's diversify over different regions. The best protection a UK pension fund can get from Brexit risk is to have foreign exchange exposure, because that will do really, really well in case of a hard Brexit. The third one is don't be recklessly prudent. What we mean with that is ensure you target an appropriate level of return that taking into account your confidence risk and all kinds of other things, so things which are really relevant for yourself, so that you can benefit from the times things go really, really well, and you can basically create a buffer for when it becomes really, really tough.
So you don't miss out on market upside.
Exactly. So what we said in one of the previous questions, the fact that interest rates are now very low actually means that historical returns on bonds have been very, very high. Mm. If you weren't hedged enough, you have missed out on the opportunity. That sort of missing out risk continues to be there, and you need to sort of look at the appropriate risk in your portfolio. And very often is our experience, people don't take enough risk because they see so many risks in the environment. And then last but not least, coming back to what I said, where I opened with, is risk premia vary over the cycle. And if you know this, and if you accept this, and if you accept that managers, by analyzing the cycle really carefully, can add value to this, then this can help investors to tilt their portfolio towards asset classes which are at the right place in the cycle at this moment, and therefore generate an extra return in their portfolios.
Right. Very interesting. Well, drawing all of this together, could you just talk about what this outlook means for clients, for the way we run money as a house and the way we look at long-term themes as well as short-term risks in our investment process?
Yes, absolutely. So I think as we've highlighted, the short-term and even to some extent the medium-term outlook, and the fascinating aspect around the medium-term outlook really is that we have really some binary events on the horizon that will shape the medium-term outlook to an extent that is very difficult to assess on where we stand today. So this is why the cycle is so important, and this is why we do spend time to make sure we understand the individual ingredients to make sure we can assess then on how politics and everything else we've just discussed will influence, i.e. potentially accelerate or decelerate on what the base case is. And that is essential, that how we then communicate with clients to make sure they understand their own risk positions. Because again, it depends on what the outcome is the client would like to achieve and how we then help them understand our views and then assess the asset allocation. What we do on top, and this is what you've been referring to in terms of the long-term themes, is obviously the understanding on what we see as very structural drivers that will shape to some extent industries, companies, but that might have an influence on industry margins, i.e. valuation concepts as well. And we believe it helps very often to add value to the analysis of the economic cycle to really bring it all together and really identify opportunities. We've talked a lot about risks here. We should not forget there are opportunities out there. And they're not always linked just to the cycle. They can be thematic in nature. And hence, we do spend a lot of time making sure that our entire research team is really geared into this macro thematic process and bring it all together into the big picture.
Right. And that also includes environmental, social and governance themes as well.
Absolutely. That is obviously a topic that is really integrated into our research process. We do not see this as an add-on because we believe at the end of the day it is about the understanding of those risks and make sure they are embedded into our investment thesis is how to solve the riddle on you know how to address ESG in your investment portfolio.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, that's actually quite a reassuring message on which to end this fascinating discussion that has encompassed the human mind, angels, reckless prudence, central banks and risk management. Emil and Sonia, thank you very much for joining us today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To read the Outlook, please click on the link in the show notes or visit elgym.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.